from Bhagavad Gita as it is. Bhagavad Gita as it is the translation and authoritative commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who is the founder and acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. In Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, Krishna outlines the contents of the Gita in summary. And there's a very, very nice verse that sums up the initial premise of Krishna consciousness in chapter 2, text 30, which I'll read for you. Dehi nityam avadhyoyam dehi sarvasya bharat tasmat sarvani bhutani natvam shochitam arhasi. O descendant of Bharat, he who dwells in the body can never be slain. Therefore, you need not grieve for any living being. Now, Srila Prabhupada comments on this verse as follows. He says, the very first step in self-realization is realizing one's identity as separate from the body. I am not this body, but I am spirit soul, is an essential realization for anyone who wants to transcend death and enter into the spiritual world beyond. It is not simply a matter of saying, I'm not this body, but of actually realizing it. This is not as simple as it may seem at first. Although we are not these bodies, but are pure consciousness, somehow or other, we've become encased within the bodily dress. If we actually want the happiness and independence that transcends death, we have to establish ourselves and remain in our constitutional position as pure consciousness. When we live in the bodily conception, our idea of happiness is like that of a man in delirium. Bodily conception of life means to assume I am young or old, black, white, rich, poor, Indian, American, adi, so many bodily conceptions of life that are all essentially false. So that is the cause of all of our suffering, as he'll explain next. In the Bhagavad Gita 2.14, Sri Krishna points out that all of our miseries are due to false identification with the body. Matras parashastu kaunteya shitoshna sukhadukhada agamapayino nityastansthitikshasvabharata. O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O sign of Bharata, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. In the summertime, we may feel pleasure from contact with cold water, but in the winter, we may shun that very water because it's too cold. In either case, the water is the same, but we perceive it as pleasant or painful due to its contact with the body under different conditions. So this is therefore called conditional life. We're living a conditional life in a bodily misconception. And this is what's causing all of our difficulty. He goes on. All feelings of distress and happiness are due to the body. Under certain conditions, the body and mind feel happiness or distress. Factually, we are hankering after happiness for the soul's constitutional position. This is the second time he's used this phrase. Constitutional position. What does it mean? Your constitutional position. You know, natural. What do we say?
Natural position.
Lakshana. Your swarup. Yes, swabhav. Exactly. So, this is our constitutional position is to be happy. To be. Not to be. As Shakespeare said. To be or not to be. That is the question. So, we want to be. We don't want to not be. This is the idea. So we want to be, and we want to be happy all the time. This is our constitutional position. And therefore it causes a problem when we are in this bodily misconception of life, because what is the nature of the body? Jatasya hi dhruvam mrityur dhruvam janma mritasya cha Tasmad Parihariyarthe Notvam Shochitamarhasi. Elsewhere in chapter 2, Krishna says, for everyone who has taken birth, death is certain. Zurur. And for those who are already dead, rebirth is also certain. This is the thing. So we're in an artificial environment, and our natural constitutional desire for eternal happiness is being frustrated at every step. And what's frustrating it? This is what he's already said. All feelings of distress and happiness are due to the body. Under certain conditions, the body and mind feel happiness or distress. Factually, we're hankering after happiness, for the soul's constitutional position is that of happiness. The soul is part and parcel of the Supreme Being. Part and parcel. Like what? Like a drop out of the ocean. Like a spark out of the fire. Like a gold ring taken from a gold mine. This is what it means to be part and parcel. So the soul, that's us, each of us, we call it Atma. This is part and parcel of the Supreme Being. And the Supreme Being is Satchit Ananda Vigraha, the embodiment of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. Indeed, the very name Krishna, which is non-sectarian, means the greatest pleasure. Krish means the greatest, and Na means pleasure. Krishna is the epitome of pleasure, and being a part and parcel of him, we hanker after pleasure. A drop of ocean water has all the properties of the ocean itself. And we, although minute particles of the Supreme Whole, have the same energetic properties as the Supreme. So if you want to know God, you have to know yourself. If you know who you really are as spiritual, in essence, and if you understand the nature of spirit, that is to say, and if you identify as that spirit, then you can have a hope to understand God, because God is the Supreme Spirit, as he said here. Satchit Ananda Vigraha. He's not making this up. This is standard throughout all the Shastras. We find these words. Ishwaraha Paramaha Krishnaha Satchit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govindaha Sarva Karana Karanam. This is one example. The Supreme Ishwara, the Supreme Lord, is Krishna, and he has a form, which is eternity, knowledge, and bliss. We also have our own form, and that form is also eternity, knowledge, and bliss. But that form is now covered over by what? This. The sthula sharir, the gross material body made out of so many elements, and the subtle material body inside. What's that? The mind, the intelligence, the ego, the desires, the feelings. This is the subtle material body. So these encasings, they cover the self. And it's, I gave the analogy last night. It's kind of like you have a program running on your computer, but the desktop is cluttered over by so many other things. How many people here are in the IT sector? Raise your hand if you're working in IT. A few. Maybe it's a good analogy then. Everywhere I go, actually, people are working in IT. There used to be engineering in the last generation, you know, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering. Now it's all seems like IT. Anyway, so if you have your desktop running and so many things are on the desktop, it's you can't really see whatever program is running underneath, just like your firewall, for example, or something. So you unclutter your desktop, you remove those programs, or at least you minimize them. Your programs can still run, don't get worried. But you double-click on those, and then you see what's actually there. So this is called self-realization, and this self-realization allows you to understand the nature of God also. If you understand yourself in fact, then you can understand God. So first we have to understand that I am eternal. Then we can understand why I want happiness all the time, and why I always want to know. Does anybody want to be out of the information loop? Raise your hand. if you want to be like completely out of it and not in the know. No, of course, because it's natural to us. Nobody wants to cease to exist. Nobody wants to be out of it, and nobody wants to be miserable. Everybody seeks after eternity, knowledge, and bliss because this is our constitutional position. So, what is that? Muktir hitvanyatha rupam sarupena vivastitihi, Srimad Bhagavatam describes. This is in a nutshell what it means to be liberated. Liberation means you throw off all the extraneous dross. You turn off all those programs that are covering up your desktop, and then what you're left with is sarup. That is what you are. That's liberation. It doesn't mean you have to grow four arms. It doesn't mean you have to end your individuality or merge into some sort of nirvana. It means you just become aware of who you are in fact and act on that platform. So Prabhupada said in the beginning here, very poignantly, it's not simply a matter of saying, I'm not this body, but of actually realizing it. Period. This may not be as simple as it may seem at first. Period. So to act on the platform of spiritual consciousness is actually pretty difficult for us. Why for us? I mentioned a moment ago the word conditioning. We are conditioned. We are conditioned. And it's just like if you are... I mean, has anybody ever had this experience when you're in a train, for example, when you take the train in India, you know, it's just going and going and going for miles. Finally, when the train stops in the station, you look out the window and you almost think that things are still moving, isn't it? That is called conditioning. And we're conditioned like that with the attitude of being this body. So long we're in this material world. So long? How long? Raise your hand if you're over 100 years old. Do you believe me? Actually, all of us are over 100 years old. We're going with this. This body is not that old, but this body is just the latest chapter. What about last time? Where do you get your desires from? Where do you get your karma from? It's called anadi karma. It's going on since who knows when. You cannot calculate how old this thing is going on. So we're all transmigrating from one form to another, impelled by this bodily misconception of life, and that conditions us even further. The longer you stay in this mode of life, then the longer, the harder it becomes to get out of it. You become conditioned by it. It's like the Stockholm Syndrome. Anybody know what that is? So you're a psychologist. So can you explain very briefly what it is?
When you fall in love with you have sympathy for your captors.
Somebody kidnaps you, and then, you know, I remember when I was a young kid, they kidnapped Patty Hearst. Anybody old enough to remember this? It's American history. Anyway, famous daughter of a rich man, and, you know, he was a newspaper tycoon. So they kidnapped her, and somehow or other she became sympathetic to them, and she became a revolutionary, and she even robbed a bank. She went to prison for it. You see? So this is our condition. We are so convinced that we can have this life that we want in this material world forever that we're constantly chasing that dream. And it impels us to do the craziest things, the things that are not in our interest or anybody else's interest. And then we run up a big, huge bill. And then at the end of life, they tap you on the shoulder and say, excuse me, can you step into this room? You have an interview with Yamaraj. So Shankaracharya ne kaha ki Bhagavad Gita kinchir adhita Ganga jala lave kanika apita sakrit apiyena murari samarsha kriyate yasya yamena na charcha. That means, if you have studied in this human form of life, even a little bit, if you've studied Bhagavad Gita, if you have nicely tried to worship Murari, even once, then if you've taken a little bit of Ganga Jal on your tongue, like Charanamritam, then when the time of death comes, you will not have to have this interview with Yamaraj. You'll not have to discuss your karmic debits. But the rest of us, this is what impels us to go on and on and on. We do things, we chase after our dreams, and we get all entangled, and sometimes we even know that we do the wrong things. Isn't it? Arjuna asks this question in Bhagavad Gita. Kena prayoktoham. How is it that as if I'm engaged by force? What is it that impels me to do things, even I know they're wrong? And what's Krishna say, his answer?
Kama
esha, krodha esha, rajoguna samudbhava. It's this lust, it's passion, it's the anger that results when that's frustrated also. These are the things that push us to do the wrong things in life. And then we run up a karmic bill, and then we've got to balance the account in some other life. We've got to come back and enjoy or suffer, and then this goes on forever, and it cements our false ego to the bodily concept of life that we're discussing. It's like case-hardened false ego. Case-hardened. It's very, very difficult to saw through this thing. So, in this Kali Yuga, we're very fortunate, because although we have this, we've gotten ourselves into this big mess, there's a special dispensation given in light of the fact that in this age it's as described in Srimad Bhagavatam. Anybody know the verse I'm thinking of? Prayin alpayusha. Generally people have short lives. How long do you live in this world? Maybe nowadays about 60 years, 70, 80 maybe. My grandfather lived to be 99 years and 11 months.
Wow.
Just almost made it. So they're short-lived. Prayin alpayusha sabhya kalau asmin yuge janaha manda sumanda matayaha. They're not only, manda means they're not the brightest bulb in the chandelier, so to speak. Manda means you're little dense. And sumanda mati, your intelligence is also lazy, especially in regards to spiritual life. Manda bhagya, we're unfortunate. We have bad karma. Hi upadrutaha, and we're always agitated. Because the lifestyle that we live right now, it actually creates and nourishes and compounds these tendencies that are natural to the age. Even within Kali Yuga, it's actually possible to live a relatively peaceful existence if you know how to do it. But modern society, we don't know these things. It's amazing to watch India and how India is changing every year dramatically. I took this new Yamuna Expressway from Delhi to Vrindavan. And just, right around the time you get to the motor speedway of all things, Formula One racing, my friends, outside of Noida. And then you see, a vast ocean of apartment complexes that look just like this one. And they even have names that just, Chelmsford Downs, for example. India. It's as if they're wanting to erase something that can only be effaced. Something to think about. Anyway, the point that I'm making is that we end up cementing our relationship with this material world through this false ego that we refuse to give up. How we refuse? What is Shankaracharya also? He's another nice one. He says, Anyway, just now I don't remember, but he says, the day is coming and the night comes, the dawn rises, then dusk comes, and one day passes, another day comes, and time is playing like this, winter and summer come and go, kala kridati, gachati ayu, and the life eventually departs, tarapina munchati asha vayuhu. But even then, a person does not give up his high hopes, which are as dear as life. Asha vayu. Vayu means prana. So hope springs eternal. What's a good example of this attitude that we have? Jarasandha. Anybody know the story of Jarasandha? one of Kamsa's friends. Kamsa was Krishna's maternal uncle. Both of them are asuras. They're both demons. So Jarasandha, he was so eager to avenge the death of Kamsa after Krishna killed Kamsa that he thought, let me attack Mathura. So he attacked with his army, with great gusto. And Krishna defeated him thoroughly. So he went home disappointed. And for a Kshatriya, dishonor is worse than death. They have pride very deep, and they can't stand that. So it must have really singed him. Then he came back again the following year, and again he was defeated. He came back again the next year. Again he's defeated. Year after year after year, he keeps coming. Every time he's completely smashed. Finally, after 17 years, he's coming again, and he tries to attack, and this time Krishna just wiped out every single member of his army, including his charioteer and his horse. And he's on foot, and he had to walk back to Magadha. But hope springs eternally. Even then, he didn't give it up. Does it sound familiar? We no matter what we do in this material world, we can't seem to figure out that it's not supposed to work. It is planned obsolescence. It is supposed to fail to make us question, is there not a better way? Am I maybe doing something wrong? Do I even know who I am, perhaps? This is the idea. So, verses like this one, it's fascinating information. I mean, of course, for those of us from India, maybe it's not entirely new, but you'd be surprised. I mean, nowadays, you know, I look at Indians and they look like Mexicans more than Indians quite a bit of the time. And, I mean, it's true. There's no more any luster, and, you know, the things that they do is just, it never ceases to amaze me. And so it's natural that nowadays you hear questions like, well, whose father was Sita again? Whose father was Sita? These kinds of questions, I actually hear them, believe it or not. And I guess, you know, maybe the Modi government will change things, but nowadays, you know, they don't teach these things in school anymore. Did anybody learn any dohas when you were in school, or any subhashita shlokas? They used to teach these things.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's like even in America, they don't even teach grammar anymore. You can work for the New York Times and be functionally illiterate in America, because nobody teaches grammar anywhere. Maybe in college you'll get grammar if you're serious. Therefore I say, Shukdev Goswami said, Manda sumanda matayaha, manda bhagya hi upadrutaha. We're even within the artificial environment of Mahamaya, this material world, we're in a particularly bad period. And it's very tough. And my point that I'm making roundabout way, long way around, is that in this Kali Yuga, although it's so unfortunate, there's a special dispensation given. Kaler doshanit hai rajan, asti hi eko mahat gunaha, kirtanat eva krishnasya muktabandha parambrajet. He tells Parikshit Maharaj in Srimad Bhagavatam that although this ocean, this Kali Yuga is like an ocean of flaws, an ocean of dosha, and we're drowning in that, there's one good quality, and that is that simply by doing this Krishna Kirtan, especially this Maha Mantra Kirtan, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Simply by Krishna Kirtan, two things happen. Muktabandha means you become freed from all these binding factors, the conditioning, the false ego, the Kali Yuga, all these things that pull us down every single day, every minute of every day. Even at night as you sleep, it's going on. How? Sangat sanjayate kama. Sangat. From association, your desires develop. What does association mean? Sangha means, going together. Everything, the whole thing, whatever goes with life, that is Sangha. And it's coming in your 10 organic senses 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even when you sleep. Because in cities like, maybe not this city, it seems like a small place, but you know, in big cities in America mostly, even if you're trying to sleep at night, you hear the nishacharas outside. And the nishacharas have these mega boom systems installed in their cars. You know, that stuff has an effect on your consciousness. And everything else as well. The television set when we came in, there were these blissful cartoons going on. And I mean, everything has an effect on the consciousness. Therefore, the Shastra gives certain vidhis and certain nishedhas. You do this, you do not do that. It's all arranged in accordance with the principles and the scientific understanding of Sankhya, Sankhya philosophy. I don't want to dilate too much on that, but the point is that we're constantly being infected by so many things, just by dint of this age. And so we need a very, very powerful process that can just slice through all of that contamination. And this is chanting Hare Krishna. So Mukta Bandha means you become freed from all the ugly stuff. And then Param Vrajet means you not only become liberated, because that's just tabula rasa, that's just a clean slate. But you Param Vrajet means you go into the higher realm of transcendental variety, transcendental love, transcendental desire, transcendental attachment, transcendental whatever it is that we seek erroneously. In this world, it's there in the spiritual realm. And it is affected for us through this agency of chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna,
Krishna Krishna, Hare Krishna,
Krishna Varanam Tusha Krishnam Sango Pangasra Parshadam Yajnayi Sankirtana Prayar Yajanti Sumetasaha. The intelligent people, it's stated in Bhagavatam by Kadabhajan Muni, the intelligent people in this age, they take shelter of this Sankirtana, Samyak Kirtana, all together, like we've done tonight, chanting, you know, group appeal to the Supreme Lord through His holy name. And then we get so much purification by this process. So we encourage everyone to chant Hare Krishna. It's a very simple thing. It doesn't cost any money. There's only three words, and you already know them. Hare Krishna, Rama, in a certain order that's not so hard to learn. And every day, if you chant this Maha Mantra, your life will change, if you actually have a serious, sincere desire for elevation, spiritual purification, every day. If we just, maybe 5 minutes, even 1 minute, at least once a day you can chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. If you don't want people to think you're crazy, you can even do it when you're in the shower, there's anywhere. No, what is that? Niyamena Nakala, right? There's no hard and fast rules as to how you do it. You can chant japa when you're alone, you can chant kirtan when you're with others. It's so easy thing. And in Kali Yuga, it has been made easy because spiritual life is hard enough when we're so conditioned as we are. Just like waking up is hard enough when you're very tired. The alarm clock, nobody likes to hear the alarm clock when you're tired and asleep. That is the conditioning of sleep. And we're conditioned by the slumber of Maya, the illusory energy of the Supreme Lord. And anyway, it's a powerful process. It's an ancient, time-tested one. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that so many people have become purified. Vita raga bhaya krodha manmaya mam upashrutaha bahavo jnana tapasa puta madbhava magata. They've become purified by this method, and they have attained madbhava, love for me. That is the perfection of a human life, a truly human life. I said the other night, humanity is not defined biologically. Dharmasya hina pashubhisamana. Without dharma, a man is like an animal. Running around, Prabhupada said, the animals are running around looking for eating, sleeping, mating, and fighting on their four legs. And we're doing pretty much the same thing in a more sophisticated manner on our four wheels. But there's not any difference. So To become a human being means to cultivate this great wisdom. And let me tell you one last thing, and then we'll stop. It takes one generation of neglect only to wipe out thousands and thousands of years of cumulative wisdom and culture and spiritual knowledge. It's such a great shame. And, you know, this is what we're seeing right now, because people are so intoxicated by a bad association, in effect, Maya. You know, they're taking these jewels and just throwing them out the window. And they're at best, they're looking for cubic zirconia instead. Diamonds, you know, you throw them away, and you're looking for something, cut piece of glass or something. So, we should take advantage of Jabalagataname Tapana Vyapai Tabalaga Kari Hari Sela, one poet said. While you have a working mind and body, while you have this rare window of opportunity that is the human form of life, take advantage and use it for what it's actually meant. Otherwise, you'll be blessed with another form that is meant for whatever else it is that you want to do. I live in Vrindavan every day because, you know, in Vrindavan, village India, they don't care so much about the sophistication. Here we hide everything. But in Vrindavan, you get pigs running wild everywhere, and, you know, monkeys are all over the place, so dogs. You know, all these options are there, and you see how they live. You know, if you want to eat indiscriminately, if you want to mate indiscriminately, if you want to fight in order to protect those interests, right? If you want to sleep all day long, all night long, the options are there. There are 8,400,000 other species. But the human life is meant for this. Right. This is our humble appeal. It's a very easy process by hearing from Bhagavad Gita and keeping association with sadhus. And we chant this Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, we can become so much benefited in life. So please consider and take this opportunity up. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Does anyone have any questions or any comments on any of these things? Or in general about spiritual life? Or even material life?
Sometimes you tell people, let's say they are into meat eating, and you tell them that the horrible consequences of eating meat, of what bad karma it brings. And then you say in the next life you may have to suffer for this, what you are doing. People think next life is like some very, it's a concept.
Yeah.
It's not like a real, I mean, who knows? The feeling is like, who knows whether there is a next life or whether, I mean, although in India it's known.
It's like a phantasmagoria. It's like a will-o'-the-wisp, or, you know, what do you call it? Pushpa Vimana.
So, what evidence you want to present in for the...
Well, the next life, especially when we're young, the next life seems like it's like hardly relevant. You know, get with the real world, will you? This is the attitude of the conditioned soul. But in fact, to be in touch with our future is called strategic planning. Isn't it? Shreyas, raise your hand if you're not planning to send your children to school. Just raise your hand. Everyone in the room is thinking about the future. But it's limited to this body only. Why? You know you're not your body. I think most of you have at least this much sense. So what's the problem? Therefore I said, not I said, Shukdev Goswami said, Manda Sumanda Mati. Sumanda Mati. What else could it be? And I know, my karma is probably worse than that of everyone else in this room. So it's hard for me also. But this is what it means to be a human being. Use it or lose it, as they say. The human form of life is actually meant for this thing. So, and then as we get older, this is another thing. I took care of my elderly mata until she left this world a few years ago. And I could see that, you know, I mean, her lifelong policy was that she always told us that if I get so old and so difficult that you know, it's like I have to be hooked up to tubes and everything, then, you know, just don't, I don't want to live like that. Just, you know, pull the plug and let me go. This was her lifelong commitment, and everybody knew it, including the POA. When she had her massive stroke and heart attack, the doctor told us that she's got maybe 2-3 days left. And so we actually had to have this uncomfortable conversation that, Ma, you know, if the doctor says that, you know, if we pull out this plug, then maybe you'll live for a couple of more breaths, but that's it. And so at that point, she reversed her position entirely. Lifelong position, she, on the spot, she turned on a dime. Exactly reverse. We don't want to die. When death is right there waiting for you, you're not going to want to face it. And so it's better to face it now. That's called strategic planning. It's better to face it now and do something about it. You can do something about it now, because this is human life. The animals cannot. They're locked into that paradigm. They have no portal out of that eating, sleeping, mating, defending syndrome that we all suffer from. I mean, we have animal residue in our minds. That's why we have the same tendencies that they do. But we have this one facility that they don't have. And that is what the yoga school calls the dharmendriya, the sense, the faculty of dharma, the sense of perception of dharma. So, yeah, when we get old, then the next life is really not so cosmic. It's going to be tomorrow for some people. And death is like that. You are forced out of this body. We don't know when. Nobody knows when. And when I was in New York, somebody had a very nice shloka written on the wall. It said, I don't remember the Sanskrit now, but the meaning was in the effect that now you should remember the name of Ram with every single breath, because there's actually no guarantee that you have either another breath or the name of Ram otherwise. Isn't it? When you die, I mean, you know, then it's all over. There's no more any choices. We're whatever we've done, the big door slams shut and you're going wherever you've chosen by your actions or inactions. See? So it seems like it's a long way away, especially when we're young, but believe it or not, you will get old. if you're not killed first, and that also happens, doesn't it? In Houston, there was one of our congregational members. The boy was a little bit nonsense boy, mischievous. So he was like 12, 13 years old, he got the car keys. And he and his friends decided to go joyriding, and they were near the freeway, and he slammed into one of those big concrete pillars that holds up the freeway, dead on the spot. I had to go to the funeral. And I know the people very well. How do you console such a person? You see? So there's no guarantee even that we're getting old. But there is a guarantee that everyone in here, nobody gets out alive. That's the bottom line. Nobody gets out of here alive. Everyone, the mortality rate in this room is 100%. So it's just a matter of strategic planning. You make a plan for transcending the ego that binds us through things like death and rebirth. And then we're set. There's no more any problem. Do not be so carried away by the vicissitudes of Maya, by the waves of illusion that distract us so much. Use your human intelligence and strategize for your future. Is that okay? Anything else?
Question.
Koi Prashna, yeah.
So if I understand correctly, I think the Maya is the external energy of Krishna.
That's correct.
Why did Krishna create the Maya? Because that creates a lot of problems for our material. Right?
Look at it this way in terms of analogy. For those who didn't hear the question, Maya is the external energy of Krishna, so the illusory energy, we also say. So why did Krishna create this Maya if this Maya is what binds us to the world of suffering? I mean, it doesn't seem like it's a very fair deal. Look at it in terms of city planning. City planning. When they build a new city, just like Chandigarh in India, anybody's from Punjab, you know, They planned it out very carefully, how to design everything. So they don't plan on having criminals, but it's expected that there will be criminals, and therefore they build a prison. And in that, in similar way, it's not that Krishna desires that everybody has to suffer at the hands of Maya, but those of us who do decide to check out the illusory energy, then we get wrapped up in it. It's like a vortex, and it's very difficult to get out. So it's a process of, essentially, it's a process of attitude adjustment, as they say in the American penal system. You know, Ishadapeta, those who have turned away from God and entertained the concept of competition with God, or envy of God, in effect, you know, they have to undergo the school of hard knocks. And it's something like a child touching fire. You only do it once, and then you don't do it again. You know. You know, once we've been burned in this material world by Mahamaya, then we know very well, if we have actually learned our lesson. But most of us need to cook a little longer, it would seem. It would seem that way. So it's not that Krishna wants everyone to suffer, but in order to relieve us of the burden of this false ego and this impossible dream that we are so attached to, the dream of becoming God, basically, is what it amounts to, then, you know, you have to have a system that is planned not to work and such that you are brought to the stage of questioning. Is that okay? Anything else?
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
So thank you very much. So the people like us, those who come from India, either for studies or work here, and we had some culture given to us by parents. So we come here, we experience the material comfort here. The basic needs are taken care. So then we fall into the trap, like, you know, the materialism and being enjoying the facilities. But one day we finally, okay, forget it. So there is no joy. So I want to turn into spiritual life. So now there's so many people out there with a different kind of philosophies. And the people who are even the sincere seekers with a lot of disturbance. So somebody says something, somebody says something else, and then totally confusion.
It's like Astar television or something.
Yeah. So many options. We don't know which is authentic, which is not authentic, confused, and some people always reject everything. So going back to that. And some people struggle in between. So what's your comment on it?
Well, this is actually, Srila Prabhupada has commented on this in his commentary on Bhagavad Gita chapter 4, text number 10. Very important verse. Srila Prabhupada has answered this question as to, you know, we get so confused by hearing so many things in this world, and it's bewildering, and sometimes we just get completely flustered by it so much. This is what happened to my mother. She just said, I want to wash our hands of it. Prabhupada calls that frustration or anger in chapter 4, text number 10, in his commentary there. Vita raga bhaya krodha. So raga, there are three things that snare us in this world. Raga means attachment, usually to sense gratification, either gross or subtle. You know, subtle sense gratification would be, you know, subtle things in the mind, you know, emotions, relationships, perhaps, feelings, you know, literature, thoughts, philosophy, science, like that. And gross sense gratification means eating, sleeping, mating, defending, fast cars, fast life, all this sort of thing, bank balance, ityadi. So that's called raga, attachment. We have these material attachments. That's one problem. The second problem is
bhaya.
We're afraid of our spiritual identity. This is a very big one, and it's understated in his purport. We're afraid of our spiritual identity. We think that if I take up spiritual life and live in spiritual consciousness, I'm going to like be put into some wild artificial state that is divorced from anything that I can relate to. That's what we think. That's called fear. Actually, what's really happening is we're being reinstated in our natural position. But we don't believe that. Therefore, we're afraid of it. The reason we don't believe it is because we're conditioned again, as we said. So we're afraid of our own spiritual identity, and especially people generally, we see, they take to impersonal understanding, some sort of void, you know, Buddhistic sort of, you know, impersonal, you know, something very vague, because it's safe. The more specific it gets, the more we start getting nervous. And the idea of eternal personality, whoa, eternal personal existence. We've had so many problems in this world with personal relationships, is it not? Personal relationships can really, really burn you out in this world. And we assume that in the spiritual world, if there's personality, that means I have to deal with that stuff forever? No thanks. That's why Buddhism is so popular. And in India, we don't have, Buddhism is not so popular anymore, but you know, Shankaracharya and his pseudo-followers have, you know, turned Hinduism into something equally vague and dubious through this Advaita philosophy, which is actually not applicable in any practical sense. That's another matter we won't get into. But Prabhupada says the fear is of our spiritual identity, and therefore we avoid spiritual, we don't talk about it, you know. I remember when I was taking care of my mother, I spent many hours, many days in the hospital wards and in, you know, by her bedside. She was there for more than a year. And so I got to talk with several nurses, and believe it or not, even doctors. Some of them will deign to talk to you. And, you know, some of them told me that, you know, we know about these things. We know that when people are dying, these people come and visit them from some other plane. And, you know, we know these things, but we're not allowed to talk about them because we can't explain them, which means basically we're afraid of them, you know. So that's fear. And then the last thing is maybe the most relevant, anger. Vita raga bhaya krodha. Krodha means, what is anger actually? Who knows? The trajectory. Beginning with contemplating the objects of the senses. Jayato Vishayan Pungsan. Somebody was quoting this verse a moment ago. Kamat krodho vijayate. You see, krodha actually comes when our desires are frustrated. So frustration and anger, they're pretty much the same thing. And the frustration of hearing so many things, either that you cannot apply because of attachment or fear, or that you don't understand because it's very subtle, and you're not subtle. Or rather, the absorptions that you are wrapped up in are not subtle. Therefore, it becomes very difficult, and it's discouraging in a major way. People get discouraged from spiritual life. That's called frustration or fear. So this is the problem. But when we hear from proper authority that are, you know, spiritual masters who are coming in bona fide parampara, and who are repeating the same thing that Krishna says himself in Bhagavad Gita, then everything is very clear. This is my personal experience. Personal experience. When I was very young, but growing older, and hopefully some intelligence was developing, I began to read so many things. And I read many editions of Bhagavad Gita, many editions, multiple editions of Bhagavad Gita I had read. I could not understand any of them. Now, 30 or 40 years after the fact, I can recognize quite easily that the reason that I could not understand all those Bhagavad Gitas is because the persons who translated and edited those Bhagavad Gitas also did not understand. Because they were not coming in bona fide parampara, and they were not repeating everything just as Krishna has taught it in the text itself. And why would somebody want to do that? Business. Business. Someone was telling me the other day that, you know, they were involved in some yoga group, and then they could recognize that, you know, the business end was a little bit more serious than the spiritual end of it. You know, people take Krishna's book because it's so widely known, but they present their own thing and they make a career out of it. There are so many of them. So this is the problem. And they add to the confusion that frustrates people, as you're asking about. But when I read Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, everything was crystal clear. And it was also very comprehensive. And it was also authoritative. And it was inescapable to see this. I could not deny it. Therefore, I surrendered. Because I was a little interested. Anyway, is that okay? Anybody else have any questions or doubts or complaints or anything? No, you're just scratching your neck.
Scratching my neck.
All right, well then, if all else fails, then at least I can depend on him, because he always comes armed with questions.
Yeah, the same, the questions, the second part. So, so finally people, okay, now so I want to read Bhagavad Gita. And then finally they come to bona fide Bhagavad Gita, people started reading. But however, when I started reading, but I don't want to associate, the notion comes in, I just want to know myself, I just want to read myself, I don't have to go to temple, because my heart is temple, my home is temple, I know it, my mother said, my grandmother said, there's another thing we come across. So how do we talk to these people in saying that you cannot find out yourself, but you need a guru?
You know what Srila Prabhupada said, his question is that we come across people, sometimes they have Bhagavad Gita, they read it also, but they don't really want to associate with the sadhu. And maybe they don't want to find a guru either. They just, you know, keep it in the house, and you know it's private, and I do this, you know. That's the idea. So Prabhupada actually addressed that in his Bhagavad Gita. I mean, actually Krishna himself addresses it in Bhagavad Gita. But Srila Prabhupada always pointed out that there is a method to accept this teaching, which Krishna mentions in the Bhagavad Gita itself, in chapter 4. Evam parampara praptam imam rajarshayo viduhu ityadi. This thing is actually received in a disciplic succession. And later on he makes it even more explicit when he says, tad vidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadyakshyanti tad jnanam naninas tatvadarshanaha. You go to the tattva-darshi, the person who has seen the truth, those persons who are wise, those persons who are coming in parampara, and you serve those people. You inquire from those people. They will enlighten you. This is the process. In short, this is why we have spiritual masters. Because on our own, it's kind of like, you know, I mentioned this last night, it's kind of like trying to cook a pot of khichdi with the pot suspended 30 feet above the flame. Maybe it could happen, but it's highly unlikely. You have to follow the standard process, and that means that you have to know what the standard process is. And it's not like the standard process is not in the Bhagavad Gita. It's right there, but people don't read. Or they hear from the motivated person who's going to twist and twangle it to suit his business aims. You see? This is the problem. I mean, actually, Prabhupada said very clearly when he was instructing his disciples how to preach Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada said so simply, he said, just memorize Bhagavad Gita and say nothing but that. Speak nothing but that. It's actually possible to do that. When I read Srila Prabhupada's commentaries, at practically every sentence, because I've studied widely, every single sentence that goes into the commentary, I can trace it to some other place in the Shastra, a verse that I know. He's paraphrasing. Either that, or he's very closely paraphrasing the commentaries of the predecessors, such as Sridhar Swami and others. He doesn't invent anything, because everything is already there, but people don't know this. This is the problem. It's kind of like if you want to buy gold, you can go and, spend your money at Chor Bazar to buy your gold. But you're going to need a lot of good luck if that's your process. The better thing is to find out what is real gold. How do I check this thing out? I want to know if it's for real. You see, if we do this with gold, then why can't we do this with something that's more valuable than gold? You see? I mean, again, this is strategic planning only. The information is very clear in the Bhagavad Gita. But we're hearing it from people who are not very transparent. That's really what it comes down to. People who have inserted their own agenda or have twisted it a little bit because they don't like certain things, or, you know. No adding, no subtracting, just the straight thing as it is. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada translated his Bhagavad Gita edition is called Bhagavad Gita as it is. Yatarup. Because he's simply presenting the thing that he has received in Parampara, without adding anything, without subtracting anything. This is the system. Is that okay? Okay? Yeah.
Thank you, Bhupa.
Partha.
Yes. So I was wondering if you can speak, because every Sunday we have a small group and this question always comes up, the relationship of Guru and Shishya, and finding the initiating guru, and seems like we are blessed, we have a lot of initiating gurus, but how to find the initiating guru and being able to have that, do we need to have that personal relationship, or is it okay that you're not able to reach your guru all the time?
Well, there's a few questions embedded in that one. Let me take the essential question first. Do we need a spiritual master, a guru? Yes, we need that. This is, again, it's something that Krishna has advised in Bhagavad Gita, and in case you're in doubt about that, it's confirmed elsewhere in Srimad Bhagavatam and so many other places. It's an august institution within Hinduism I think everybody here probably respects. And so it's not that much in question. but can we become Krishna conscious without a guru? To some degree we can, to some degree. But in general, this is not just a process of accumulating data, and it's certainly not a mechanical process. There is an element of grace here, which is essential. It's the path of grace. We require mercy, and that mercy comes from a person. And Krishna acts in this world basically through his spiritual masters, the acharyas, and the devotees also. The mercy descends through the devotees, through the sadhus. And so, if it were just a matter of accumulating a certain quorum of, realizations, or if it were just a matter of, following certain rituals, then it might be okay to just do this on our own. But when we actually come to recognize the crucial importance of receiving grace, because we can't do anything without mercy. It is what sustains us, in fact. Then we realize that is like the clincher when it comes to the need to accept a spiritual master. But, a spiritual master also serves so many other purposes, because when we have practical questions, just like people often ask me, how can I learn Sanskrit on my own? You can't. You're going to have questions. And you need somebody that you can just call up and ask your question. So simple. You see? Otherwise, it may take you months to pour through so many books and finally find out the answer to a question that's bothering you. It's like that with spiritual life also. We have a spiritual master and we serve him. And the process of serving the spiritual master, you're entitled to ask a question. And the spiritual master is his duty to answer the question. So that the relationship is perfect. We just have to take advantage of it. And as far as getting the guidance we may need from a spiritual master who perhaps has 40,000 other disciples, well, that is a difficulty, and that's something to consider when we're looking for a spiritual master. In our line, we put a lot of emphasis also on shiksha gurus, as opposed to only Diksha Guru. Generally, the system is the person who gives you Diksha is also giving you Shiksha. But if that's not possible for whatever reason, then there are so many others who can also help. I personally, when I joined ISKCON, I was very, very young, and I only saw Srila Prabhupada once, during his last visit to Los Angeles, once or twice. I never had any personal interaction with him, other than to offer flowers and hear the Bhagavatam. Never, he didn't give me any personal instructions. Practically, there was not really a relationship there in a direct personal sense. But I was very, very carefully trained by those that he very carefully trained, namely Tamal Krishna Goswami and others. And it was very beneficial. So that's also a valid approach. But it's up to you as to which one you're going to have to take. You know. And, you know, this is a matter of faith, ultimately, beyond certain standards of behavior that are expected for any acharya, and that you have to know first, because otherwise how do you know what you're looking for? You've got to know what the standards are. And exactly the same way as I said a moment ago, when you go looking for gold, you know, there's so much stuff out there that is not necessarily gold. So you have to know how to test, is it real gold or not? The information is again there, but you have to study and you have to hear. And mainly it comes through association with others, like-minded persons who are trying to become sadhus. You know? And these are a few ways to answer that question. Is it okay?
Yes, thank you.
Anything else?
So in Bhagavad Gita, there is, sometimes people say there is so many different kinds of yogas discussed.
In Bhagavad Gita?
Yeah.
Okay.
Karma yoga, dhyana yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And many times people say, oh, karmani vatikaraste mahapadeshu kadachana. This is like, you have a right to perform your duty, and this is the highest thing in the Bhagavad Gita. So, would you like to say something about, you know, what is the highest thing that is spoken about in the Bhagavad Gita? Because
yeah, okay. So, you mentioned that there are different kinds of yogas, so which one is the best one, maybe? And, you know, is it karmani evadhikaraste? Is that the highest platform? Well, in chapter 6 at the very end, the concluding verse of chapter 6, Krishna says, yoginam abhisarvesham, of all the yogis, madgaten antaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yomam same yuktatamomata. I consider him to be the most properly engaged if he is worshipping me with great transcendental love and faith. That is the best yogi, Krishna says. And if that's ambiguous for someone, then just, you know, compare it to the other verses that we find throughout the Bhagavad Gita, such as Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakto Mad Vyaji Man Namaskuru, which he says twice in chapter 9 and again in chapter 18. How about Bhaktyama Bhivijanati Yavanyaschasmi Tatvataha Bhaktya Tvananyaya Shakya Ahamevam Vitorjuna Ityadi. So many verses are there. It is clear that the bhakta is in the topmost condition. Now, having said that, there are other aspects that one has to assimilate. In karmanya evadhikaraste, it's a fact. Your adhikar is to do your duty only. And you cannot neglect your duty. You have to do your duty. Ma phaleshu kadachana, and this is the part that people kind of forget. You cannot have the fruits of your duty. You have to offer those fruits as well to Krishna. And you cannot even take too much pride in your work, which is what he says in what is it? The next line. Ma karma phale heturbhur. You should not think that I'm the one causing this fruit. And ma te sangostva karmani. You cannot not do your duty also. So what is this? When I went to University of Hawaii one day, no, he came to the temple, one professor from University of Hawaii, his name is, I think, Raghunath Sharma, very accomplished Sanskrit scholar, and he and I had a discussion, so I had some questions to ask him, and he wasn't entertaining questions that day. He said, no, just understand this thing. How does the pedestrian understand this teaching of Bhagavad Gita? Krishna tells him these four things. You got to work hard. You can't have your paycheck. You can't take pride in your work, and you can't be inactive. He said, what is this if not slavery? So the point of this is that we should assimilate, aside from the fact that your duty is necessary for what he calls social solidarity, that is to say, loka sangraha. The point here is that you have to do something, and somebody has to do something about these children also, because it's just too much. So you have to do something practical. That is the point. Once that's well established, then Krishna starts getting into the more subtle aspects of, you know, for whom you have to do it and how do you do it, ityadi. And by that time, I mean, like I said, at the end of chapter 6, it's pretty clear that we're going in the direction of bhakti. In chapter 9, it's unmistakable, especially since it's repeated again in chapter 18 at the very end, the last word. It's just like the Shruti Mantra, Shvetashvatara Upanishad. What is literally the last word of the Shvetashvatara Upanishad? Does anybody know? Famous verse, you know it. Tasyaite kartata hirtaha prakashante mahatmana. Unto whom is the meaning revealed? Yasya deve parabhaktir yatha deve tatha gurau. The person who has bhakti. Equal bhakti for the guru and for Krishna. The idea. So this is just a quick overview. I mean, you know, we can write books on this topic. There are other lessons in Bhagavad Gita, and they are important. They should not be neglected. But they're useless unless they culminate in bhakti. This is the point. Srimad Bhagavatam makes this explicit. Shrama eva hi kevalam. You may do your duty so nicely, you may even practice yoga or accumulate so much gyan, but bohunam gyanavan mam prapadyate, bohunam janmadam ante, gnanavan mam prapadyate, ityadi, Krishna says. I mean, it's so many places, but again, we just don't know the Bhagavad Gita. We haven't read it, that's all. It is very clear if you actually are familiar with what the Bhagavad Gita actually says. So, is that okay? Anything else? Yeah, please.
You were saying, Prabhu, about our conditioned nature. And sometimes we recognize that we have conditioned nature, and our perception of what's going on or decision we are making is somewhat affected by our conditioning. Now, in the case, like for example, like accepting guru or someone like that, we know that we're supposed to act in a particular way according to Shastra, but still we have some freedom to make our own decision.
Yeah.
Now, to what degree our conditioned nature plays a big role in this case?
That's
because,
right.
Because our decision is, you know, on the base of our experiences, on the base of our knowledge and stuff like that. Nevertheless, there is such a scope of making mistakes.
Therefore, Krishna warns us, you should know where your enemy is sitting. The enemy is sitting in the senses, in the intelligence, in the mind. You have to monitor. You have to be very cautious and be aware. This is like, what is that? Self-awareness is the first stage of therapy, right? You've got to be aware of your. You've got to be aware not only of the theoretical identity that we learn from the Shastra, my spiritual identity, you have to be aware of your material identity also. That's called your swabhava. Because that swabhava has a corresponding swadharma. There's a corresponding duty that is obligatory as well. And we have to be aware of that. Otherwise we can make mistakes. So this is why we have association with sadhus. You know, they can guide us and, you know, help us with this sort of thing. But we have the primary responsibility of educating ourselves. You know, who is a bona fide guru? What is a bona fide disciple? You know, what are the criteria of Krishna consciousness? What are the basic teachings of the Bhagavad Gita? Then when we accept our spiritual master and begin to actually follow the process of bhakti yoga formally, then we get very deep in this. And then everything becomes, you know, absolutely solid, absolutely clear. It's not just a quest, it's not a very superficial familiarity. It's very deep familiarity. That's what initiation is actually meant for. So initiation itself is a very major step, because you make the wrong decision, it can ruin not only this life, but every future life as well. You have to be so careful. That's a very quick answer. I hope it's satisfactory. Okay?
One last question. So this, among the Indians, when we talk about Bhagavad Gita, there is one more common question we hear. Madhav Seve.
Yeah.
So if you're serving the people, take care of the needs and give them medicine, the food,
yeah,
and hospitals, that's good enough. We don't have to.
Okay.
So would you like to comment on that?
Madhava Seva is a very common conception in modern India. It is not a common conception in the Shastra, actually. In fact, the Shastra says, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, if you want Smriti Shastras in Bengali, he says, Bharata Bhumite Hailo Manusha Janmajar Janmashartha Kori Koropar Upakar. When you become perfect, then you can actually help someone else. You can actually do seva for someone else only after you have become Krishna conscious. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's opinion. Now, if we don't value Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's opinion, then we have to value the opinion of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because Srimad Bhagavatam says, Yatha toror mula nishechanena tripyanti tat skanda bhujo pashakaha pranopaharachayatendriyanam saravarham achyutejya. That means that just as watering the root of a tree will automatically distribute that water to the branches and to the twigs and to the leaves and the fruits and flowers, similarly, when you worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, then, you know, yasmin tushte jagat tushtam. When Krishna is satisfied, everyone else becomes satisfied. When you worship Krishna, automatically all the other devatas and everyone else in society, everything becomes auspicious. This is what the Shastra says. It's not that humanitarian seva is, I mean, it's a laudable thing. It's a kind of karma yoga that Krishna endorses in chapter 12 even. Does anybody know where? He says, if you cannot fix your mind on me, then at least follow the regulative principles of sadhana bhakti. If you cannot do that, then at least try to give up the fruits of your action. And if you cannot do that, then at least try to do something for someone. You see? That's okay. To develop selflessness, and that's, I think, the core virtue in this sort of, you know, Madhava Seva ideal. That's a good thing. It purifies the heart. It's not bad. But it is not the supreme perfection, and it should not be presented as such, because it's not what the Shastra says. We have to, you know, we may have our very strongly held convictions, but we have to accept the authority of Shastra. This is called Shastra Pramana. There's a very beautiful verse in the Mahabharata, and then we'll end, because it's getting late. He says, Tartako pratishtha shruta yo vibhinna na savrishir yasya matam na bhinnam tat dharmasya tatvasya nihitam guhayam mahajano yena gata sapantha. That means you cannot just read the Shastras and argue about what they mean, because the Shastras appear to be contradictory on many occasions. You cannot, I mean, even the Shruti mantras, what to speak of the Smritis, they're very, they say so many things, it's confusing, as you said before. And in fact, one doesn't even establish himself as a bona fide rishi unless he says something different. Just like when you go to college, you don't get the PhD unless you say something new. Right? So the real truth of dharma is actually hidden within the heart of the unadulterated pure devotee. Therefore, the actual conclusive path is to follow whatever the Mahajanas advocate. Follow that path. Mahajana yena gata, whatever path they have trod before us, sapanta. That is the path that we have to follow. So this is the ideal, I think. I mean, if we hear from the acharyas, they're not saying these things. Who is saying these things? The persons who are saying these things, this, you know, Madhava Seva is Madhava Seva idea, they are chiefly 19th century Hindu reformers. They were all British educated. Every last one of them. British educated. It's not traditional Hinduism. That's just something to consider. Practically any group that exists now in Hinduism is either, you know, it is directly the heritage of one of these, you know, 19th century reformers, or a further offshoot from one of them. You know, Paramparagat Hinduism is practically, it's practically gone. So that we have to consider that. What are the ramifications? I hope that's okay.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to end now. Thank you very much for very kindly listening and attending tonight. I hope it's been helpful for you.
Thank you.